From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Most of what readers know about John Updike's life is what he's chosen to reveal through his fiction. But Updike steps out from behind the shield of fiction in his new memoir, Self-Consciousness. On this edition of Fresh Air, John Updike reads from and discusses his memoir. A now-celebrated essay by Linda Nochlin asked the question, why are there no great women artists? Her answer helped launch the feminist art history movement. Coming up, Nochlin talks about women, art, and power. And we have reviews of the new album by the British rock group XTC and the new movie, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. John Updike is joining us for a return visit to Fresh Air. Updike is the author of 36 books, including Rabbit Run, Becca Book, and The Witches of Eastwick. He's won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the American Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. In spite of his achievements, Updike has tried to keep a relatively low public profile. Celebrity, he writes, even the modest sort that comes to writers, is an unhelpful exercise in self-consciousness. Celebrity is a mask that eats into the face. As soon as one is aware of being somebody, to be watched and listened to with extra interest, input ceases, and the performer goes blind and deaf in his over-animation. In the past, Updike has been reticent to reveal much about his personal life to his readers, but he reflects on his life in his new memoir, Self-Consciousness. In the opening paragraph, he explains why he uncharacteristically chose himself as the subject of a book.
Shortly before the first of these personal essays was composed, but several years after the soft spring night in Chillington that it describes, I was told, perhaps in jest, of someone wanting to write my biography, to take my life, my load of ore and heap of memories, from me. The idea seemed so repulsive that I was stimulated to put down, always with some natural hesitation and distaste, these elements of an autobiography. They record what seems to me important about my own life, and try to treat this life, this massive datum which happens to be mine, as a specimen life, representative in its odd uniqueness of all the oddly unique lives in this world. A mode of impersonal egoism was my aim, an attempt to touch honestly upon the central veins with a scientific dispassion and curiosity.
Can you explain that fear of somebody taking your memories from you to write a biography?
Well, a writer's life isn't quite like a statesman's life, you know. It's what you write out of, and I just didn't want to be and don't want to be intruded upon in that way. So as a defense against intrusion, I decided to invade my own privacy with these essays. At least I would know how to do it and would do it with good taste and delicately, and I'd know where to go. And if my life is of any intrinsic interest, and I'm not sure it is of much, I'm the one who's lived it, and the kind of things that I write about in this book are certainly things that a biographer would not fasten upon.
Are there any things that you dislike about the form of memoirs that you tried to avoid in your own?
Well, I tried to avoid a merely sequential account of events. In my case, there aren't that many events in my life. The main events, aside from the births of my children and my two marriages and the deaths of my seniors, have been the books themselves. So the biography is quite adequately stated on the back of the jacket, really, in a few words. There is no life except seen poetically, as it were, seen with a metaphysical search in mind.
Well, the poetic device you seem to use is your body. The revelations in the central part of, you know, in the middle part of your memoirs come not from your career as a writer, but from your body, from physical ailments, from psoriasis, from a stutter, from asthma.
Yes, well, they what seemed to come to my attention of those moments of discomfort. And remember, the title of the book is Self-Consciousness, so I fastened upon those things which either made me self-conscious, like the psoriasis, or which showed self-consciousness, like the stuttering. And the religious aspect of it, again, has to do with the question of a self at all. Why do we seem to have selves that we prize greatly? Do computers, with almost as much circuitry now as human brains, do computers have selves? Are computers self-conscious? Is a wasp self-conscious? I think not. It's a kind of specifically human thing, which I was interested in exploring via my own poor little set of facts.
You first got psoriasis in kindergarten in 1938. Did people in the literary world know that you had a skin problem before you wrote about it?
I don't know. I suppose some did. I wrote a kind of amusing, I've always thought, short story called Journal of a Leper, or From the Journal of a Leper, which is about psoriasis, and which is much quoted in medical texts of a certain kind. Psoriasis is rather rarely written about. We're all shy about it, those of us who have it, and wish we didn't and don't want to talk about it much. So it took a long time for me to confess to it. I feel it's some, you know, it's a sin of some kind. It's a dermal sin, and it took me a long time to believe that it wasn't really my fault, and I could talk about it more or less freely. No, I don't think it was commonly known. I'm told it doesn't really much show, and the discomfort has mostly been self-produced rather than other people produced.
Well, were you worried about calling attention to it, though?
No, not really. A writer is somebody who tries to tell the truth, right? And your value to your society is a certain willingness to risk being honest. And so to be honest about this was part of the general job as I see it.
Well, I think you found a lot of universals in the particulars of your experience with psoriasis. And I'd like to ask you to read an excerpt of your chapter on psoriasis. And my guest is John Updike, and this is a reading from his new book, Self-Consciousness.
Psoriasis keeps you thinking. Strategies of concealment ramify, and self-examination is endless. You are forced to the mirror again and again. Psoriasis compels narcissism. If we can suppose a narcissist who did not like what he saw, in certain lights, your face looks passable. In slightly different other lights, not. Shaving mirrors and rear-view mirrors in automobiles are merciless, whereas the smoky mirrors in airplane bathrooms are especially flattering and soothing. One's face looks as tawny as a movie star's. Flying back from the Caribbean, I used to admire my improved looks. Years went by before I noticed that I looked equally good in the lavatory glow on the flight down. I cannot pass a reflecting surface on the street without glancing in hopes that I have somehow changed. Nature and the self, the great moieties of earthly existence, are each cloven in two by a fascinated ambivalence. One hates one's abnormal, erupting skin, but is led into a brooding, solicitous attention toward it. One hates the nature that has imposed this affliction, but only this same nature can be appealed to for erasure, for cure. Only nature can forgive psoriasis. The sufferer, in his self-contempt, does not grant to other people this power.
There's a sentence in there that I think probably a lot of people will really see themselves in, and that is, I cannot pass reflecting surface on the street without glancing in the hopes that I have somehow changed. I really think you put your finger on something there.
Well, I'm happy to hear it, because I've always thought that nobody except me was annoyed with the way they looked or self-conscious to this degree. But I guess we all are. It's a strange thing, isn't it, to be born into a certain body instead of an ideal body. And all of our faces, the whole idea of a face is slightly funny, isn't it? If you can put yourself outside of the species a moment, that these faces we carry around with the holes in them and the shining holes and the dark holes and then the one that shows a lot of teeth, it's all odd beyond belief, really.
Yeah, well, you feel like, well, it's my face, but my face isn't my fault.
Right. It's not your fault, but it is what you're stuck with.
Well, you seem to think that it's some of your weaknesses that have made you what you are, some of your defects, like psoriasis. You think that you became the person who you are and the writer who you are because of it.
Well, I think it forced my attention away from any very public career, like being an actor or a school teacher, which is a kind of actor, and what my father did, and was that was the profession that society had more or less laid out for me. And I think my determination to avoid teaching is in part a shyness of any kind of public performance daily, putting yourself there, trying to look good. So I've been extra serious about making it as a freelance writer, where I don't really have to come out of the closet, where I can do the whole thing at a distance and in a room by myself via the mails. So yes, in that extent. Also, psoriasis has made me be a little bolder than I might have ordinarily been, and it certainly got me to the Caribbean. I've seen a lot of lovely islands that I wouldn't have seen if I didn't have psoriasis.
You said it made you bolder. You write, only psoriasis could have taken a very average little boy, a boy who loved the average, the daily, the safely hidden, and turned him into an adaptable, ruthless enough writer. Where does the ruthlessness come in?
Well, I think telling the truth is kind of a ruthless act, and both in specifics, since you do invade some privacies in fiction, and in the larger way, you are trying to, or I am trying to, as it were, rub humanity's face in the facts of our existence, that there is much that is ignoble and desperate about being a human being, and my fiction is in part motivated by pointing these things out. So yes, there's something ruthless and cruel. Even to generate suspense is a bit of a tease, isn't it? So there's a kind of a sadistic element in the writer's attempt to keep the reader's interest.
You write, when the medicine wears off, the medicine for your psoriasis, when the medicine wears off, I will become hideous. I will become what I am. With a sentiment like that, I would have expected you to be writing horror movies. So that's really horror movie material.
Yeah, no Stephen King I. I'm a mainstream writer, not a genre writer. I think there's enough horror to be detected in under the skin of the normal existence. I am interested, in a sense, in the violence within the home and betrayals of all sorts and with our cruel side. But I try to braid all this into a realistic picture of normal life. I think any genre like horror, which offers itself as an escape from reality in some way, is a step down from what I'm trying to do.
At the end of your chapter about your skin, it's pretty well cleared up because of some experimental treatments you were getting. Did you have any problems after writing about this? A lot of people believe that psoriasis has a component of psychology behind it.
It has a psychosomatic component.
Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. So I was wondering if really thinking about it a lot and writing about it made you any more symptomatic.
I didn't have a flare. We call that a flare in the trade when your psoriasis suddenly goes bad again. And I do say in the piece that it rather resists all these treatments, that when I was young, a few days in the sun would do marvels. And the older I got, the longer it took. In a way, the tougher the skin and the psoriasis became. And so would the artificial light treatment, which for 10 years gave me 10 years of feeling pretty good about myself and my skin. Now I'm on a pill. Which also has done a pretty good job. So I'm not at a very dermally stressed moment in my life, and I wasn't aware of... In a way, it's a relief to have it all out there, and I put it out not to say poor old me, but lucky me. Lucky me that I had this affliction, which made me be a little original and which forced me, as it were, into the artist's isolation, which gave me the courage to try to be an artist.
There's another thing that comes out of it, too, I think. You know, when you're reading about somebody facing problems that they've endured, you don't want to come out of it feeling sorry for them. You want to come out of it feeling kind of invigorated and that you learned something about yourself through reading about them. It's really probably very hard to write about the subjects that you're writing about in your new book without getting self-indulgent or even maudlin. I mean, you don't want your readers to feel sorry for you. And I think you've really succeeded with that. I mean, that's not the feeling you'd have at all, is feeling sorry for this guy. You feel like, wow, these are things I've really thought about.
Well, I see myself as pretty lucky, really. I was a small-town boy who wanted to be a writer, and I've become a writer. And every day I wake up kind of grateful that I've been given this opportunity. So, no, I don't feel basically sorry for myself at all. And even while writing about these adversities, I was trying to be to an extent, funny about it.
Exactly, yeah.
And some of them are quite funny. The teeth chapter, the teeth section, for example, is some people tell me, hilarious. It was painful to suffer through, but writing is this funny kind of magic. You know, you can take a series of painful experiences, and just in writing about them, you somehow get rid of the pain.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your new memoir, but first we're going to take a short break. John Updike is my guest, and his new memoir is called Self-Consciousness. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Updike is my guest, and we're talking about his new memoir, Self-Consciousness. You also devote a chapter in the memoir to the stutter that you had. And you say in it that, you know, with the stutter and the psoriasis, when people wouldn't acknowledge it, when they wouldn't mention it to you, you'd wonder, is this invisible to other people?
Well, you don't know how bad you look or sound to other people, and there's always the hope that, in fact, you look and sound fine. I have rarely... The stutter comes and goes, and when it does come, is embarrassing to me. My wife tells me it's charming, but I've never found other stuttering people especially charming, so I kind of take that with a grain of salt. But yes, I guess there is the hope that if at least it might be noticed but not written about, and it was this article written by a reporter for the Jerusalem Post that came right out and talked about my stutter. I was uneasy in that situation. I think I was tired from jet lag, and I didn't quite, I was cast into a role where I felt uneasy, and as I say in the piece, I think that's when I begin to stutter, is when I feel somehow mistaken or uneasy in the role I'm performing.
You say something that I think, again, a lot of us will have experienced, that when you take something that's supposed to be unconscious, like the act of speaking, you know, moving your tongue around to form vowels, and it suddenly becomes a conscious act, you lose yourself, you lose it. It's like when you think about walking with grace, you walk really stiffly. When you think about breathing, you become really conscious of every breath that you take, and it becomes a belabored act instead of an unconscious one.
It's quite true. And speaking, you think of the number of muscular motions that your tongue is making just to form the sentence you so gracefully uttered. It's amazing it works as well as it does.
You know, the last time we did an interview on Fresh Air, we talked a little bit about why you dislike being interviewed, and about how you distrust the kind of public self that writers are sometimes forced to cultivate. In reading your memoir, I of course started to think that other reasons had to do with perhaps fear of stuttering, with fear that skin would be broken out.
Yes, both.
Okay.
Both are true, and it was a great relief when I first began to go on the television. Years ago, I was delighted to find that you got a coat of makeup, and I always felt immensely happier once I was made up, and I would wear it all day long until it wore off. So that, yes, on the other hand, having that anxiety about how you look or whether you're going to stutter or not relieves you of other anxieties, and the truth seems to be that I'm a fairly garrulous performer once I'm launched in that direction. It's almost a bad trait in me that should not be encouraged.
I want you to read another paragraph from your book, and this is from John Updike's new memoir, Self-Consciousness. And we were talking before about really so much of your body comes into play in this set of memoirs. And this is related to a chapter about asthma, and you associate asthma with a period when you tried to break out of your marriage and initially failed and then later actually broke out of it.
Yes, I did, and I hope, and I will read the section which, under the heading of trying to tell the truth. I go from stuttering in this chapter to breathing, and I think there's some swallowing in there
choking,
too.
Yeah.
Choking, which I did used to do. There's a kind of a claustrophobia, something very curious to me about the throat as the passageway whereby the heart and the head communicate. Anyway, I'm more conscious of that narrow passageway. And this is about asthma and my domestic feelings at the time, my life situation. A door had opened and shut. My timidity and conscience had slammed it shut. My wife and children were my captors, but I could not blame them. They had done nothing after all but come when I called. When young, I'd wanted a wife who would be attractive and motherly and artistic and quiet, and she materialized. We wanted children, and they obediently came, healthy and lovable, and two of each sex. Now, through no fault of their own, they composed a household whose walls seemed to be shrinking around me, squeezing my chest. No first attack stands in my memory. The squeezing, the panic crept in, and were suddenly there. Like my Barth reading and my poetry writing, for I was never more of a poet than in this angst-besmogged period, the breathlessness would tend to come on in the evening. We didn't know what it was, pure inner demons, or an ingenious psychosomatic mechanism to make my wife feel guilty about being still married to me, or what.
You know, reading that paragraph, I couldn't help but think about the claustrophobia that Rabbit feels in your novel when he leaves.
Yes, I think he very much was an early projection of this sense of claustrophobia, of domestic claustrophobia, which we shouldn't blame entirely, shouldn't blame at all, in fact, upon the, or blame much upon the first wife. I think there is a sort of a general human, or male human at least, feeling of any settled situation has become something of an entrapment. There's always the American notion of the territory west, that there is a kind of realm of freedom out there which beckons. And one way of expressing one's claustrophobia is, I suppose, to have trouble breathing.
This is the first time you've written that I know of directly about your family, and you don't write that much about your family in your memoir. But I guess I was wondering what... if your family was ever offended by things that you'd said about families in fiction... in your novels, that they assume to be about themselves.
I've been surrounded by very kind and good families, beginning with my parents. My mother, after all, thought it would be a good thing to become a writer, so she's taken her medicine, as I've written, with good grace. And my father was an immensely encouraging and forbearing man, and... my first wife and my second wife could both be described as very kind women who see, of course, that writing is what I do. Every profession has its handicaps, and a certain amount of telling is a risk you run if you get mixed up with a writer. And my children didn't ask for this. They were just born. And for the 15 years when I wrote... mostly about families, they weren't reading me, and I was grateful for that. But certainly I said nothing about them that they couldn't read. And fiction is, let's not forget, fiction. A writer who undertakes to tell a story is under no obligation to real people, really. Your obligation is to the reader and to create something that makes sense as a work of fiction.
There's one last reading that I want to get in. And this is from a section toward the end of your memoir. And it's really about, it's in part about the fears that one experiences at night, and you writing about them during the day.
Yeah, and it's about writing as a release, isn't it? As a kind of self-therapy. I do think that writers who have, any kind of social sanction for their activity are one up because... when you write about something in a strange way, you become lightened of it. Let me read this paragraph. So, writing is my sole remaining vice. It is an addiction, an illusory release, a presumptuous taming of reality, a way of expressing lightly the unbearable. That we age and leave behind this litter of dead, unrecoverable selves is both unbearable and the commonest thing in the world. It happens to everybody. In the morning light, one can write breezily, without the slightest acceleration of one's pulse, about what one cannot contemplate in the dark without turning in panic to God. In the dark, one truly feels that immense sliding, that turning of the vast earth into darkness and eternal cold, taking with it all the furniture and scenery and the bright distractions and warm touches of our lives. Even the barest earthly facts are unbearably heavy, weighted as they are with our personal death. Writing, in making the world light, in codifying, distorting, prettifying, verbalizing it, approaches blasphemy.
Do you feel ever that it's your demons that keep you writing? Even though you'd like to talk of yourself about writing, about average things, about the little corners, about the domestic news.
I think there's something demonic in the complete writer. Yes, I think that an ideally nice person would probably not become a writer. I try to write pleasantly, fairly more than pleasantly. I feel there is much in life that is frightening and unpleasant, and that we are, among other things, cruel beings, and all of the shadow side of one's self-knowledge, of course, goes into writing, and in a way energizes it. It gives you the energy to undertake this fantastic activity every morning.
Your memoir begins with you in the neighborhood that you grew up in, walking the streets, going back to the house you grew up in, and thinking about what life was like there. And you say, I wanted to feel something, but felt less than I had hoped. What kind of feelings did you experience in reviewing your life to write this memoir? Did you also feel yourself feeling less than you'd hoped?
No, I felt quite a lot writing it, and I tried to really write only about those areas that in some way were painful and would really quicken me into good memory. Nostalgia can't be endlessly renewed about the same thing. As Proust in The Masterpiece of Nostalgia points out, it must spring upon us unawares. So when I looked at my old house, I'd perhaps done that too often before to really feel the deep pang of nostalgia. But other parts of that same walk had moved me greatly. The same thing, a sudden, unexpected revival of a life that was dead, of a self that was gone.
I think that you've just completed a really, an interesting exercise in the sense, in your book, in the sense that you've taken things that had been private and made them public. And I'd like to know what that feels like to, we all have things in our lives that we think, well, if people knew about this, they'd like me less. Maybe they'd even put my work into some kind of different light. They'd question my motivations for things. And you've taken some of those things and made them public. What's it like?
Well, better me than another, I figured. And I do have the writer's control over what I choose to divulge. And my self-knowledge is imperfect. And of course, there's a lot I left out. But in a funny way, this book, now that it's completed, becomes just one more book. And I feel oddly detached from the John Updike who it's about. I mean, I feel almost like he's a character in fiction and I'm walking away from him. So I don't feel utterly involved, even in this rather confessional self-exploratory work.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you so much for your time and for doing the readings and for talking with us about your book. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Updike's new memoir, Self-Consciousness, is published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Lester Brown. He's the founder of the World Watch Institute, a think tank and research center that every year publishes a State of the World report, which examines the world's ecological health. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, women, art, and power. Feminist art historian Linda Nochlin examines the conditions in the art world that have historically prevented women from becoming great painters. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Oranges and Lemons, the new album by the English trio XTC. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, the new fantasy film by Terry Gilliam, the Monty Python alumnus who also made the movie Brazil. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm. There was more testimony in the criminal trial of Oliver North today that appeared to link President Reagan with specific knowledge and approval of military and intelligence aid to the Contras at a time when such aid was banned by Congress. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
President Reagan's possible involvement came up today in a memo from Oliver North to Robert McFarlane. The memo asked that President Reagan approve the airdropping to the Contras of intelligence information and two Honduran recoilless rifles. The memo said both the intelligence information and the rifles were needed to sink Sandinista ships carrying arms. The memo was written on October 30, 1985, at a time when Congress had specifically banned all military and intelligence aid to the Contras. McFarlane testified today that he did not remember receiving the memo, and he noted that his deputy, Admiral John Poindexter, had apparently handled it. Indeed, on the memo, Poindexter wrote these words, "President approves." There was no testimony today, however, as to whether the president did in fact approve or whether Poindexter just said he did. But the memo added fodder to the pile of inquiries that is rapidly mounting at this trial as to how much the president knew and when he knew it. A spokesman for Mr. Reagan said today the former president would have no comment on pending legal matters. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Three federal agencies today announced that it's safe for children to eat apples. The statement by the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Agriculture Department was designed to calm fears concerning the effect of a preservative used on apples. The Natural Resources Defense Council had released a report saying young children were at risk because they eat more apples than adults, so they are exposed to more of the chemical that has been linked to cancer in test animals. President Augusto Pinochet of Chile today criticized the U.S. embargo on Chilean fruit, calling the measure excessive. The U.S. halted the importation of fruit from Chile after two grapes were found to contain cyanide. Pinochet said the small quantities in the grape were hardly enough to kill a mouse. Meanwhile, the foreign minister of Chile met today with Secretary of State James Baker on the crisis. Later, a joint statement said the two sides were committed to working together closely on an urgent basis to solve the crisis and restore fruit imports. At roundtable discussions in Warsaw today, Solidarity and government negotiators cleared the final obstacles to the union's legalization. One of the most controversial issues has been Solidarity's relationship to the government-authorized unions, which for 7 years have enjoyed a monopoly in state-run enterprises. Details from Jane Dobia.
When the roundtable's proposal for complete union freedom becomes law, the official union may face competition not only from Solidarity, but other labor organizations as well. The government is worried what might happen when several unions make conflicting demands on factory directors. Negotiators today decided such matters require direct consultation with the union's rank and file. At earlier talks, the two sides already agreed Solidarity will be legalized in a single legislative act, guaranteeing the union immediate recognition as a nationwide organization. A consensus seems unlikely in at least one major group dealing with economic reform at the roundtable. However, negotiators say a deadlock in that area will not block the signing of a general agreement on April 3rd. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Richard Cheney today received the unanimous approval of the Senate Armed Services Committee to become Secretary of Defense. The committee voted 20-0 to recommend confirmation by the full Senate, which was expected to vote tomorrow and approve President Bush's choice to head the Pentagon. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 20 points to close at 2340.71. Advances led declines 7-4 on volume of 180 million shares. The average price of a share gained 29 cents. This is National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Andy Partridge of the British group XTC has called his band's music weird pop. Rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to XTC's new album, Oranges and Lemons, and he has this review.
The title of XTC's capacious new collection, Oranges and Lemons, is a reference to a British nursery rhyme of the same name. The album cover is a neo-psychedelic cartoon that suggests Peter Max and the Beatles' Yellow Submarine. All of these details are clues. This English trio is tipping us off to the fact that this is all kid stuff. After a decade spent being perceived as an intellectual post-punk band, and then a failed post-punk band, XTC has made the strongest album of its career by going against type. If Edward Lear and Lewis Carroll had formed a band with John Lennon, they might have sounded like this. All but three of the 15 songs on Oranges and Lemons were written by lead singer Andy Partridge, who is not a typical rock star, but who is very much in the tradition of English eccentric artists. He describes himself as aggressively mundane, which is not the sort of thing you hear much in the age of Michael Jackson and Madonna. For almost 10 years now, Partridge has refused to take XTC out on tour because he hates the imperfect way the band's music sounds on stage and because he suffers from stage fright so severe that he used to faint in mid-song. Partridge is the father of two young children and has no interest in writing rock songs about drugs or sex, or at least his interest is expressed in the most elliptical, teasing manner. He has said of a new song called Pink Thing that the title phrase comes from the fact that when their first child was born, he and his wife took to referring to it as the little pink thing. But having written the song, Partridge says he realized that people might also hear the lyric as a euphemism for a penis, and that he likes this possible confusion. Anytime you call. XTC has had a series of hit singles and albums in England, but only cult success here. In 1987, the band stirred up a small American controversy. The song Dear God incurred the wrath of fundamentalist Christians here for its jauntily framed assertion that religion exerts too much control over its followers' lives. Once the song was attacked, Partridge responded with an unexpected snappishness. Instead of backing down, Partridge now says that he wishes the song had been, quote, more poisonous. What bothered me was that some people thought the song meant I believed in God. Andy Partridge's aggressive humanism is extended on this new album with a song called Merely a Man. No. first single from Oranges and Lemons, a song called The Mayor of Simpleton, is doing pretty well in America, where its brisk, clever melody and layered production are reminding a lot of people of the Beatles. But this music has a certain tartness verging on sourness, the tang of Oranges and Lemons, that makes it very much the work of XTC alone. Never been near a university. Never took a paper or a learned degree. But some of your friends think that's stupid of me, but it's nothing that I care about. Well, I don't know what to do, the weight of the sun and the mathematics. Well, I want none, and I may be the man of Simpleton, but I know one thing, and that's I love you. When their logic grows cold and all thinking gets done, you'll be warm in the arms of the mayor of Simpleton. I can't have been there when brains were handed round.
That's XTC. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Feminist art historian Linda Nochlin has collected her essays from the past 17 years in a new book called Women, Art, and Power, and Other Essays. In 1971, Nochlin wrote a landmark essay that set out to answer a troubling question: why have there been no great women artists? Nochlin said that in approaching the question, the first impulse of feminists was to try to dig up lost, unappreciated women artists and make a case for their importance. But Nochlin decided that it was the wrong impulse.
Yeah, which does not mean by any means that I am not interested in women artists, both in their production, in their practice, in their relationship to wider issues of art history, their relationship to gender issues, issues raised by literary criticism, etc. I'm extremely interested in women artists. What I'm really not interested in is simply expanding the canon of greatness by adding a few women artists as sort of exceptions to that canon. I'm interested in questioning the whole production of greatness and the whole mythology of artistic genius as something uncaused, something that's innate, that will out no matter what the odds. And I want to put that all into a much larger social framework and examine not just why are there no great women artists, but why are there great men artists? That's another question, which I think comes up with that, right?
So you're looking at the nature of the art world and the art world's institutions to see why men have become great artists and why so few women have been able to rise in the art world.
Right, exactly.
What are some of the circumstances historically that have conspired to keep women out of the art world?
Well, the whole positioning of women generally as people relatively without power, not professional and so on, but then quite specifically in terms of the practice of art institutions, women were not allowed to enter the great art academies at a time when that kind of professional training was an absolute must as far as getting ahead in the field of art was concerned. A very specific detail, women were not allowed to learn how to draw from the nude model when that was sort of the whole basis of high art during the Renaissance and the 17th century. Indeed, right down through the 19th century, for various kinds of reasons having to do with modesty and inappropriateness and so on, women were not allowed to do that. So they never, if you can't paint from the nude model, you can't do the Sistine ceiling. That's pretty clear.
Another question that interests you is if women react differently to paintings than men. And I think this is an especially important question when you're dealing with the subjects of nudes and mm-hmm. erotic painting. Mm-hmm. You've said erotic means erotic to men.
Yeah.
In painting, because it's men who did most of the paintings that we know and men who decided to purchase them.
Right. And I think...
Oh, and men who canonized them.
Exactly. But I think in this respect that I've found a lot of help in modern feminist psychoanalytic theory, the whole theory of the gaze as power, including...
This is G-A-Z-E.
Yeah. Who is looking? Whose eye is it that's supposed to be fixing the object in the painting? Whose pleasure is it that incites the representation of the nude? Obviously, it's going to be different for the woman viewer, according to psychoanalytic theory, and even according to just sort of common sense, than it's going to be for the male artist or the male viewer. What is a woman's relationship, say, to the nude? If a woman is either a viewer or a painter, how does she react to the female nude?
Is there an example of a painting or a show that you can give us where you found yourself having a really different reaction to erotic subject matter or to nudes than male colleagues of yours did?
Yeah, I would say the Baltus show would be a very good case in point because it's pretty obvious. Baltus was associated with the Surrealists. I think he did some very interesting early work, and then he went on to do these sort of perverse Lolitas, either semi-nude, very young adolescent girls, or young girls raising their legs so that you could see their underwear or their lack of it, and so on. And this was a show at the Met about 5 years ago. And I called it into question, not because it was, quote, erotic, but I just wanted to ask questions like, for whom is this erotic? Why are women told that if they question this kind of representation as erotic, that they're naive or don't know anything about art or are against pleasure or against sex or so on, rather than saying, well, for whom is this erotic? Who is it? Whose erotic desire is this constructed for? What do women have to do to participate in this erotic? I mean, do they have to be masochistic? What kinds of operations, in a way, does the woman spectator have to perform in order to participate in this so-called construction of the erotic?
In raising questions about how the female body has been represented in art, you did a takeoff of an anonymous 19th century photograph. And this photograph was of a naked woman offering a tray of apples. Mm-hmm. Now, hanging on this tray were also her nude breasts, which were basically being offered as two other delectable fruits. Describe what your takeoff of this was and why you did it.
Well, what I wanted to show was that erotic metaphors, visual erotic metaphors, are not reversible. What works in the feminine, I mean, that apples breasts analogy is part of high art. Gauguin does it. He shows women displaying fruit and nude breasts on a tray. I mean, this is something that is mobile. It goes from low art to high art. When you try to reverse it, as I tried to do, I took a photograph of our studio model called Buy My Bananas, and I made him pose wearing heavy wool socks and boots, just like the woman was wearing black stockings and cute little high heels. And I brought him a tray of bananas, and I showed him where to hold it. And he got the point right away. I mean, he was a very good model. It's the only photograph I've ever really taken. It's not just a family snapshot. And boy, oh boy, this made the point right away, because he didn't look delectable. He looked ridiculous. I mean, he just looked hysterically funny. And the whole point, it was part of a lecture where I was pointing out that, you know, those who have no turf have no language. I mean, if you don't have an erotic territory, so to speak. You can't just reverse things and say that's equal. It's not.
One last question. Do you think that feminist art criticism is accepted now in the art world?
By some people, yes. But there's also a lot of antagonism, too. I would be fooling myself if I thought that there wasn't. People feel incredibly threatened. And for a lot of interesting reasons, I would say that in history and in lit crit, there's a lot more acceptance of feminist work, gender studies, and so on. Art history and art criticism often tend to be very recalcitrant because we are related to objects, and objects have value, and objects hang in museums, and objects require connoisseurship. And the kinds of questions that feminists and social historians are asking tend to lead away from objects and their values, from the art historian or critic as a kind of value ordainer for wealthy collectors or museums or people who see art as objects of supreme value. And I think we are dangerous. We undermine that whole structure.
Linda Nochlin, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Linda Nochlin is a distinguished professor of art history at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Her new book, Women, Art, and Power, and Other Essays, is published by Harper & Row. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, are you still following Chilean fruit?
You bet. And we asked NPR's Daniel Zwirling tonight, can you eat grapes? That simple question. Also, another one, can you eat apples? And we'll talk with an apple grower in central Kentucky who explains that some eastern apple people have felt it necessary in the past to use Alar on their apples to compete cosmetically with the perfect non-Alar apples of Washington State. Also, an explanation of Brilliant Pebbles, a space-based defense system against a nuclear attack. It's being recommended as a feasible non-nuclear SDI system. And we'll learn to play the Irish tin whistle tonight.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Terry Gilliam's movie Brazil won the 1985 Los Angeles Film Critics Association Awards for Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay before it had even been released. Gilliam was involved in a battle for artistic control with Universal Studios, a battle he eventually won. His latest film is Baron Munchausen. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
If you believed its advanced billing, you would already have pegged The Adventures of Baron Munchausen as one of the all-time movie fiascos, a Heaven's Gate for children of all ages. The film's shooting was plagued by disasters, and the budget eventually soared from its original $23 million to somewhere around $40 million. Terry Gilliam, the director, had been the animator for Monty Python, but lately he'd developed a reputation as a kind of anti-Hollywood bad boy, who was now overplaying his hand. And yet, the big surprise is that despite its lumps and longueurs, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen has real magic. The Munchausen fairy tales have been a part of European folklore since the late 18th century. Gilliam's movie begins when the Baron himself shows up during a theatrical performance based on his yarns and tramps onto the stage to object that the players have got everything wrong. All hell is breaking loose anyway, because the Turkish army is besieging the city. Munchausen decides to save the day by regathering his former comrades in arms, all of whom have supernatural powers, and defeating the Turks. And before we know it, we're off to parts hitherto unknown. In this scene, for instance, Munchausen, played by the Shakespearean actor John Neville, hurtles into a volcano and finds himself facing none other than Vulcan, played to the hilt by Oliver Reed.
Can I help you, tiny mortals?
I sincerely hope so. I'm Baron Munchausen. You may have heard of me. My friends and I are looking for three men. One with exceptional eyesight, one with superb hearing and powerful lungs, one who is extremely large and strong.
Oh, we're all extremely large and strong here.
Terry Gilliam has always been a collagist. His Monty Python animations derived much of their charm from the way he used the stately, antiquated images he stole from Dürer and Bronzino to act out his own all-American slapsticks. And in Munchausen, he combines the candy apple sheen of Fellini with the soaring spaciousness of a latter-day Piranesi to create a peculiarly exalted fantasy world. Munchausen unveils a universe at once vast and strangely elastic, where miles can be traversed in moments, and the strictures of space and time miraculously contravened. Gilliam turns a Turkish sultan's castle into a voluptuous circus. He lets Munchausen dance with Venus herself. Best of all, he creates a kingdom on the moon that's a breathtaking amalgam of Descartes, de Chirico, and of all things, Robin Williams, who plays its king as the mind-body dichotomy come to life. His head keeps flying off, the better to escape the body's pedestrian lusts. The movie stalls at times, and there's a bit too much preaching about the wonders of fantasy and the evils of rationality. And worse, Gilliam has the same problem here that he had in Brazil. He reaches heights halfway into the movie that make all that follows feel anticlimactic. But no matter. Those heights are payoff enough for a dozen fantasies. The Adventures of Baron Munchausen is not only Gilliam's best film. It's one of the few screen fairy tales that, like The Thief of Baghdad or Pinocchio before it, can genuinely enchant adults as well as children, widening their eyes and rekindling their awe.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. In the 1950s and 60s, Little Anthony and the Imperials had the hits Tears on My Pillow, Shimmy Shimmy Coco Bop, and Going Out of My Head. Next time, Little Anthony tells us what he's been up to since he's separated from the Imperials. Also, jazz composer and pianist Kenny Barron is featured in our weekly performance spot, and critic at large Laurie Stone comments on the new traditionalism in today's pop culture. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Peter Murdoch. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.